Technorama interview with Dr. Robert Nemiroff.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Earthrise, Crab Nebula, Rings of Saturn. Where can I keep all these awesome astronomy pics?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I am your host, Chuck Tomasi. Just after DragonCon 2012, I drove my daughter Julie up to college to start her second year at Michigan Technological University in Houghton, Michigan. I thought I would spend a few minutes with one of the professors there, Dr. Robert Nemiroff. Robert is one of the two people behind the genesis of the operations of Astronomy Picture of the Day. If you haven't been to the site, apod.nasa.gov, you must go there soon. Even if you don't have a strong interest in astronomy, these are stunning photos.
Thanks for having me on.
Welcome to the show. Hey, I appreciate you giving us some time. And, let's start a little bit about you first. Tell me about your background.
I'm a professor at Michigan Tech, which is Michigan Technological University, which is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And it's the other part of Michigan that people keep frequently forget. But we like it here. And so I'm in the physics department, but so I teach physics classes. And also, along with a colleague, a former colleague, still colleague, Jerry Bunnell, who's at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, we write and produce and pick the images for, as I'm best known for, the website Astronomy Picture of the Day, which comes from apod.nasa.gov, apod.nasa.gov. So what else do you want to know?
Oh, tell me a little bit about the history. It had humble beginnings.
Humble beginnings. Okay, yeah, so there's the short version, there's the medium version, there's the really, really, really long version. So, I don't know, there's lots of stories about the beginnings. Jerry Bunnell and I shared an office at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in the early 90s, and we saw this thing grow up called the web. Didn't know it as the web right away. It was this neat little computer program called Mosaic, which I used to connect to the Mystery Science 3000 website.
Fellow Misty.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool. It was Joel Hodgson days. And so I thought it was fun, but I thought it was essentially a waste of time. But still, people kept coming up and saying, have you seen this website? Now, I don't know if they call them website, this Mosaic thing. This other place to go on Mosaic. And eventually, Jerry and I got the idea that this was a big thing. And we were lucky because NASA Goddard had the equivalent of a cable connection back in 1994.
Ooh.
So we had more bandwidth than we could deal with. And we realized that we also had these well-connected computers. So we were in a really privileged situation at that point. So we came up with different ideas of things to do. And we did what most people do when they come up with an idea, which is nothing. So we just forgot about it for a little bit, but it kept coming up at lunch. And so eventually we decided, well, okay, maybe we should try to do something about this. So we queued one in, was it June 16, 1995, I think. And then there's nothing for the next day because it didn't seem like that good an idea. But then starting, I think it is on June 20, then we started doing it every day. And so usually we each do our own. So we usually don't collaborate on individual ones. So I will pick days or he will pick days and we'll divide them up. And then when I have a day, I usually do everything for that day. Pick the image, write the text. There's not much more than that. Link it, create hyperlinks for it, and put it in the queue where the supposed computer robot will then pick it up and post it at midnight Eastern time to be the next picture of the day. So the first day we had 14 page views, and we don't know why. How did they find us? I don't know. Maybe if you were starved for content back in 1995.
Yeah, we were.
So we happened to be in the right place at the right time. So our audience has grown continually from 1995. So we've had a really long run at this. And so we're over 17 years now. One of the longer running websites that looks the same on the web. So times it's a little bit tough. I don't know, a little bit grating to do, but many times, most of the time, it's a lot of fun. And I think we both are still having a lot of fun with it.
Now, are you still typing in the text and picking which pictures to post, or is somebody else doing that these days?
It's 1994, 1995 technology. We use a standard Linux editor, VI.
Oh, yeah.
So there's no fancy stuff going on here. We take a previous Astronomy Picture of the Day HTML file, and we edit it with the VI editor. And we just delete with the delete key the old things, and we put in the new things. So we type in the text. We write the text. Usually I will write it in a word processor first because I'm a horrible speller, and then it will underline in red all those things. And so that's why many of the typos that appear on APOD are more, you know, bear for bear, like things that the spell checker won't pick up. But yeah, so we pick out all the images, we write all the text, and everything that needs to be done. The technology hasn't broken. What's new is we now have different feeds. You know, we have a bulletin board now we call Starship Asterisk, or the Asterisk, where people can discuss this. We have a search engine specific to us that you can see little thumbnails of the images if you're interested in certain things. We have feeds on various social media now that we didn't have before. You can go to Facebook or Google Plus or Pinterest or name your social technology, and someone else has set that up for us, and we just say, okay, good, you're not saturating this with advertising, you're not doing anything inappropriate, so we will then name you on our page. And we are fortunate enough now to be translated into most major languages voluntarily. People have come forward who speak these languages many times in other countries, and we were floored when this started happening, but now we're just tickled by. We're just happy about it. And so almost no matter what major language you might speak, and even some minor ones, you can find APOD translated by someone, not by Google Translator, which isn't so bad. But and you can see that in your language. But I think English still is our most popular venue.
And there's also apps in the App Store on iTunes. That's how I consume mine, is through the... it's one of the first things I do in the morning is I'll pull up the APOD app on the iPad and get the latest one. And if I'm out for a weekend or something, I'll go back 2 or 3 days and catch up. There's stunning, stunning images out there. I assume that was also voluntary?
Yeah. So we call those our new technology mirrors, because the way we see it, it's just... APOD used to be like a web page that we designed, but now it's like a form that that people pick up, and we can't change people. You should really update APOD. It looks like it was made in 1995. Say, well, yeah, but if we change it now, all these other programs that read in APOD as input, like the apps and the foreign language mirrors that look different, they would all crash. So we would have a problem. So we like our current look because it looks the same. It's one of the few pages that looks the same since 1995. Although I will say that we're now centered. When we started, they didn't have the center tag in HTML. So the very early APODs were not centered. But now we decided to go new school, and we're centered, and we're proud. Looking at our what we call new technology mirrors, where they read in our content and put it out. There's Facebook, as I said. There's iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch. There's Twitter feed. There's a Windows Phone feed. I know there's also Android feeds now where you can get all of this. Plus, we're actually now opening up when people submit images. Now we have something called APOD Sky on Facebook that not only has the APOD of the day, but has two other images, one of which may have been submitted and one of which may have been a classic APOD from the past. And so we're upping our you know, our rate, our baud rate of how fast this stuff can come across. So we have a couple of those. There's also one on Google Plus we call iPod River. We're sort of testing them out to see how they do. There's one in Spanish now called Universo, and they update more often. But you know, where we feel pressure sort of is to keep the stream running, to keep a new iPod coming in every day in the same format, because now there's lots of higher level content that pick it up and run with it. So we can't stop.
So where does a lot of the images come from?
Okay, the images. They're so major observatories, the Hubble Space Telescope. Mm-hmm. So we're one of the reasons why we do this is because we're both really interested in astronomy and have been. I've been interested in astronomy since second grade. I don't even know when I learned some astronomy things. It goes way back to when my childhood. But I just, along the way, picked up where the major observatories were, and many of them are sent around by email. We used to be email attachments. I know where all their websites are. I would just go there anyway. I just couldn't keep away anyway. So now I can say, oh, there's a good image. But because of iPod's recent popularity, I don't even have to do that so much, because many times people are sending us stuff already. So now we get, we reject about 10 to 1. We reject 10 images for every one that we run. And we have a submissions thread now on the asterisk, so you can see many of the better images that are being submitted to iPod. And there's a lot of them. And there's just one of the heartbreaking things now is that there's now just so many good images that we can't run. And some people have put in a lot of effort, and that's great. And so what we ask them is, don't put the effort in just because you want it to appear on iPod. Put the effort in because you're a proud astrophotographer who's doing great work. And don't judge your success on us, because we sometimes go with the quirky, we go with the unusual, we go with a good story, we will go with a rerun because you already have really great text written for something. So, but then again, many of the really great images that we see coming in, sometimes, you know, right off, like, oh, wow, that's really good. Also, the big news stories, for instance, if some rover lands on Mars, recent past, like Curiosity, so we're going to know about that. So we're going to look for key and some of the best images that come across from that. So one of the things I do, and I can't help myself, I'm not even doing it for iPod, it's because it's interesting. I'm looking at what the new images from Curiosity are and thinking, oh, is that cool? What am I looking at there? You know, and trying to think, well, where's it going? What's it doing? So it's, iPod is in a sense easy to do because it's an extension of my current interests, and I'm sure my coworker Jerry Bunnell's as well. Some people think that there's this huge team of people and we own this huge skyscraper somewhere, and you know, and there's the, but no, it's sort of a, you know, two-person operation. We're still in our garage, okay? So we're still doing this in our garage, essentially. It sort of works that way. It's NASA does give us some money, so that's useful in some ways, but it really doesn't cost a whole lot to produce iPod. It's still a low-budget operation, and we really don't need a high budget, mm-hmm. because the astrophotographers and the people who create the images, they're the people who are really going to the tremendous efforts. What we do is we highlight their works. So our low technology is just a way of highlighting their work.
Yeah, it really is impressive. Some of these people, like the transit of Venus or some of the more recent events, they're in a specific spot at a specific time. They have to travel to these places. You know, think about the upcoming solar eclipse in a couple of years. There are people that are going out of their way to be in a specific spot to get a certain shot. And these are just amazing. And I've noticed that sometimes you'll run them similar images, you know, transit of Venus, for 2 or 3 or 4 days after the event has happened, because there's so many stunning images. It's got to be hard to decide.
Yeah, and it is hard to decide. There are so many stunning images. So I'm sort of glad that we have now like the asterisk, so we can put more of those in the other feeds on Facebook and Google Plus, because now we can give, you know, some other images that we just can't show a transit of Venus every day for a month. We just can't do it. It's just, we run out of things to say. People will lose interest, and yet there's still good images coming in. But so with these other feeds on Facebook and Google Plus, I think we can now give those some highlights that they deserve. So that's good for them.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics, author of the new book, Physics of the Impossible. Yet, I can't even figure out Technorama.
Now, you mentioned Starship Asterisk. Tell me a little bit more about that. You've got a whole bunch of other projects, and I wish we could have time to go into all of them. But we'll start there. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, Starship Asterisk is a bulletin board. It's, again, old technology. It's PHPBB for bulletin board technology, which was big about 10 years ago. But now it's not really the social media anymore, but it's convenient for us. Mm-hmm. So anyone can go on Starship Asterisk, and you immediately become... an astronaut, and then after you post a few times, you become an ensign, and then you become a scientist automatically by the number of posts. We don't allow discussion of controversial topics, but we have discussion of space news. There's other bulletin boards out there. We're non-commercial, and we feature a discussion of the APOD image. So we have people who are very well versed in astronomy. Professional astronomers go on there. And so if you want to know more about the image, many times the astrophotographer, if it's a private image themselves, mm-hmm. will come on to the asterisk discussion and say background of the image if people are asking. Sometimes there's people yelling Photoshop. You know, it's how can that image be real? And then although we will cut that off if we're convinced the image is real and someone's just trying to be a troll, we will cut that off. But the astrophotographer might get on themselves and talk about how they set up the image. And some of them are going to just a tremendous amount of effort to get some of these images. And in the past year, it's really come around in the past year or so, we're getting videos sent in, music videos, where people aren't just taking single images. They've got cameras, and they've got these elaborate setups, so these cameras are moving, so you see the change in the foreground scenery, and they're long-duration exposure, so you see the deep sky, and they are taken over long periods of time, so you can see the sky rotate, and you can see satellites go over, you can see aurora, and so that's something that wasn't true. You didn't have these 5-10 years ago. But now it's become cheap enough for people with, you know, a few $1,000 setups to do. Whereas before, I guess major television networks could do them, but not so many others. But now almost anyone, I guess with a smartphone and enough technology, can start taking these videos. And so it's really impressive, some of the music videos. And they're matching them to really, you know, inspiring pieces of music, too. And, of course, people will debate they like or don't like different pieces of music. But anyway, it's a new dimension that we didn't see coming that we're happy to be there for and to highlight.
Well, that brings a question. Originally, the concept behind APOD was Astronomy Picture of the Day. Mm-hmm. And the presentation of that was, here's your picture. What are your thoughts with the site as it is? How are you going to weave in the videos for something like that? Is that going to be strictly through the RSS feed or links to these YouTube videos? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Good question. So Astronomy Picture of the Day is just really a brand name. So we can do things not astronomy. We can do things without pictures, and we can do them not every day. Well, we're sticking with the day pretty strongly, though.
Yeah.
Although we're up to 3 times a day on the feed. Sometimes, like a week ago, we had one on DNA, so that wasn't astronomy. And one of our most controversial ones is when we feature Matt Harding dancing, the dancing people on planet Earth, as we're sure to get a lot of people on the bulletin board objecting to that. But those are people. So we don't always do astronomy. And a picture, well, you can interpret that broadly, too. It's the Motion Picture Academy, right?
Yeah.
And so picture can mean any number of things. So we're flexible. And yes, Astronomy Picture of the Day is what we usually do. It's usually astronomy. It's usually picture, usually day. But it's not always what we do. And if we see something really cool that is even peripherally relevant, then we'll possibly run with it.
Will Wheaton's clown sweater out of scope?
Oh, I'm not.
Oh, that's sorry. That's an internet meme. It's awful. It's awful. You have to Google that one and just shake your head and go, oh, some things you can't unsee.
Okay. So also on the asterisk, so we post other content. So I teach astronomy and physics here at Michigan Tech. So I decided 1 year to do my astronomy course completely online. Actually, I was asked to do it originally, and of course I refused, but then I decided, well, okay. And then it became, oh yeah, this is good. So I decided to take more credit for it. So the all 25 lectures are completely online. Mm-hmm. And the next time I did it, well, we used no textbook. We just used Wikipedia and APOD. So you can go see 25 lectures. And all those lectures are now listed on Starship Asterisk. They're also on the Apple iTunes. You can get those there, too. Then another class I taught, I think it was 2 years ago, was called Extraordinary Concepts in Physics. And I touched on things like Maxwell's demons and multiverse. And so by that time, I was doing a bunch of shorter lectures because I think it's been shown that the shorter lectures, no one wants to see almost anybody go for 15 minutes, let alone me. I'll get way boring. So we have about 10, 15-minute lectures there and covering some of the really cool topics in physics. Because one of the things in one of my pet peeves about physics undergraduate is that a lot of people become a physics major because of cool things like Maxwell's demon and Schrodinger's cat and multiverses, but you don't really see that in many undergraduate physics curriculums. But so I decided to make sure that if the Michigan Tech undergraduate physics majors want to see that, or anyone at the university, they can sign up and get a course, which is mostly conceptual, but still pretty cool, and they can debate some of these really cool topics that are at the forefront of physics today.
You get into quantum physics at all?
Yes, a little bit. In fact, one of my favorite things is the very strange two-slit experiment. And so where you have a bunch of photons going through two slits, and then they interfere, and then there's certain things. So then we change that experiment in any number of ways, at least 10 ways, covering up a slit, changing them. One of the most famous ways is you change the photons to electrons. Do you still get an interference pattern? And the answer is yes, you still do. You put in barriers here and there, and you keep asking the question, do you still get an interference pattern? Change it to radio waves, change it to gamma rays, things like that. And so we ask them questions there. So they're all posed. Many times I would say, what do you think will happen with this modern physics experiment, you know, with Schrodinger's cat or something like that, or one of these two-slit experiments? And then we give four possibilities, three of which are serious and one of which is just a throwaway joke. And then, you know, then the person can decide what it is, though we don't have online voting yet. I guess we could have polling if we did it through the asterisk, but it's just, those are just straight lectures in PowerPoint. And then you can see, once you've made up your mind, you can go to the next slide and you can see what the answer is and why. And I think questioning things like that and trying to come up with answers in your own mind is a powerful way of learning physics. And so I try to do that when I can.
This is David Levy, amateur astronomer, lover of the night sky, and comet discoverer. You are listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
And recently you were just published. This is being recorded in early September, and something came out on NBC that you got to be rather proud of.
Okay, so another of my too many lives. So as a jack of too many trades, master of very few, but one of my research specialties is, I truly am an astrophysicist, and I really do publish in things called journals, these academic things, and I go to conferences sometimes and present papers, and I publish an occasional paper in a refereed journal. So we recently had a really interesting result where we were looking at something called a gamma ray burst. So there's lots of gamma ray bursts. Gamma ray bursts are bursts of, you'll never guess, gamma rays. And
they're huge.
Yeah, they're some of the most powerful explosions in the universe, and you can see them far across the universe. So that's what I'm interested in. You see them far across the universe, the photons come flying across the universe, and you can tell a little bit about what's between us and the gamma ray burst by noting certain aspects about the gamma rays. How often they come, do they come in different groups, how separated are these groups, and things like that. So we have a whole bunch of data we download from satellites that circle the Earth, usually NASA satellites, and they're free to anybody, so they're free to us, so we bring them over and students and I analyze them. And so we lucked back into this group of three photons that came within a millisecond at the highest energies practically seen for gamma ray bursts. And so from that, we were able to go into an area which isn't really my main area, which is I'm not even really a theorist, quantum gravity, which says some theories of quantum gravity say that if the universe is foamy on the Planck scale, which is really, really small scale, much smaller than a nucleus, then photons traveling across the universe at very high energies will be dispersed, like you would see a light in a fog. Would disperse. It wouldn't be a point of light anymore. And you would get some photons coming in later because they bounced off of things in the fog, water droplets in the fog. So the question is, did the space-time foam, as some theories suggested, smear out this gamma ray burst? And we can put a limit on that now because we saw three photons, three GeV, very high energy photons, come in within a millisecond. So we had to do statistics on it, but we're pretty proud of it. And it was picked up here and there. And it implies we know more than we do because we're not quantum theorists. But the quantum theorists come out with what they expect to see. And so we can compare it with that.
And, of course, the news site sensationalized it. I forgot, what did the headline say? It was...
I don't want to...
Okay, we won't go there.
I don't want to insult you. Here's some of my favorite APODs, though, if you want to see.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the images.
Okay. So, one of my favorite ones is called Earthrise. And so here you can see, I'm sort of joking because I know it's a podcast.
Yeah, so
imagine if you can, in your mind's eye... the Earth rising over the Moon as seen from Apollo 8. Now, this is possibly one of the most famous images of all time, and one of the Time magazine, I think, picked it as one of the great images of the last millennium. And so as Apollo 8 came around the limb of the Moon, you could see the blue Earth. And it's frequently known as Earthrise, and it is really stunning to see because at the bottom of the image, you can see the Moon, the surface of the Moon, and then you can see the big blue ball or small blue marble that contains everyone you've ever known and all the life forms of Earth. And it really puts life on Earth in perspective, which is why I think it's one of the most famous images. Another one gets back to what it's like on the surface of the Moon. So sometimes people think I've been to the Moon, which is a little bit scary because I've never been to the Moon, and only a few people, 10 or so people, have ever been to the Moon. But I was a connoisseur of moon images way back, way before APOD. And so when Apollo 17 was sending out images, some of them are being updated now and cleaned up. So they're even better than ever before. And new mosaics are being made where you can see panoramas of the moon that the individual images used to exist. But people recently have collected them into panoramas. And if you like this as a hobby, you can do this yourself. So one of the key images is called from Apollo 17, and it's a lunarscape. It takes off on a phrase, I think, made famous by Buzz Aldrin, a magnificent desolation, which the moon is described as. Yep. So if you look at the moon, it's not really, really colorful. It's not...
pretty gray.
Yeah, pretty gray, kind of brownish gray, sort of. But in the same way, it's sort of magnificent at the same time. So that's why this is one of my favorite images, because it just shows you... clearly, I mean, you can see there's the lunar rover. You can see an astronaut. I think that's Harrison Schmitt. And you can see mounds on the moon that are mountains. And it's just really cool looking. You get a feeling for something where there's not much there, but it's really magnificent in its own way.
Beautiful.
So that, I think, is pretty cool. Okay, how many more you want me to do?
Prominence.
Yep. Here's a prominent image. But I'm bummed. We just need somebody with a rim shot here. So our sun, which we're fortunate enough, is real constant, because if it wasn't real constant, we might have trouble maintaining life here on Earth, developing life here on Earth. But as constant as it is, as that it gives out pretty much the same energy every day, it still, in some small ways, is very variable. And so it has prominences, and it has flares. And so with modern technology, you can take pictures of these flares. And so NASA and other space agencies have satellites that some orbit the Earth, some orbit the sun near the Earth. And they're constantly, we can now see the entire sun all the time. Way back only 10 years ago, you could only see essentially the sun from the Earth. Mm-hmm. The sun is also coming into solar maximum around now, showing a tremendous amount of variability after coming off an unusually low minimum where, for reasons that nobody knows, it was just unusually dormant, where there were times where nothing you could really call a sunspot would go on for months.
Yeah.
And no one predicted that. But now we're getting back where you can see flares, and so these make great pictures, and they're violent, particularly when you see one of these short-term videos, and you can see the sun sitting there, it's about to do something, and then suddenly it jumps into action, yeah. And this huge cloud comes off it. And so you can see prominences. So here, as you can see on the lower left, okay, I'll give you a clue. It's this one first appeared on November 9, 2005, and you can see what seems to be a claw coming off the sun. And that claw is much bigger than the Earth. And but if it went through the Earth, it wouldn't really cause a lot of problems because it's very thin. There's it's plasma that's not very thick. And it's just a tremendously violent event, but it's not enough to do anything more than create aurora or slightly compact the Earth's magnetic field for a short time on Earth. But it looks really cool.
Now, up here in Houghton, Michigan, are you far enough north and clear enough skies that you can see the aurora during some of these?
Well, the further south you go, the more aurora you can see. So, yes, we get more than Florida, for instance, which rarely gets aurora. I'm always reminded of one time when I was driving up the lower peninsula to get to the upper peninsula on I-75 for people who know Michigan. And I was just lucky enough, through the front windshield, I was fortunate enough to just see aurora for hours at a time. And
wow.
They were nice and, you know, I could sort of tell the green and they kept changing shape. But we don't, we're south of Seattle, so we're not, we're sort of in the middle of Lake Superior, but so we get a lot of snow, but we're not that far north. But we do get more aurora than the average place would see. Hopefully the next year or so will be good for aurora for much of the United States. Because we're hoping that there will be solar storms that don't damage satellites or damage power grids, but still create visible aurora for much of the major metropolitan areas. We're hopeful.
Wonderful. Hey, I know we've got a limited time, and I appreciate it. What's next? What's coming up for you, Robert?
I'm gearing up for my class I teach this time, Introductory Electricity and Magnetism to 350 Michigan Tech Engineers.
Wow.
So that's always a hoot. Fortunately, I have a teaching assistant who's actually doing most of the work.
Like any good professor should.
Yeah, and he's happy about it. So at least he smiles anyway when we talk about it. So that's going to be a bit of work. So I'm always working on my iPods too, and working on my research, and every now and then getting some sleep. So,
if somebody's looking to find APOD, what's the best starting point?
APOD.nasa.gov, go to Google and type in astronomy or APOD or something, because we're not that hard to find once you know our name. So if you type in astronomy picture of the day, pretty much any search engine, it'll come up.
And if they're looking to volunteer, say somebody wants to help update the site, I know you said that's a touchy subject because of all the feeds that come into that, but I would have to imagine a lot of them are consuming the RSS feed or some other standard format at this point. But if somebody's just looking to help in any way, maybe it's create a new app or something, or manage a social media network or something, how would they do that?
Yeah, great question. So actually, we've polled our audience. According to our audience, 75% of the people who look at APOD pretty much go through the main NASA site.
Okay.
But still, the other ones are coming up. The Facebook feeds haven't taken over yet. But if you're interested, so you can send me an email. You can find my email address on the website, or you can go to Starship Asterisk. We have a board where people can, you'll see that, help wanted. But certainly, we can always use intelligent people who are willing to help out in some way. There's lots of little jobs that can be done. I mean, the base core site is taken care of, but there's always more feeds and more things and answering email even or something like that that we can use help with. So if someone really wants to help out, yeah, please get in contact with Jerry or me, and we'll fit you in somehow.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Robert. It's been a pleasure, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Once again, I want to thank Dr. Robert Nemiroff and encourage you to go to apod.nasa.gov or download the iPod app, visit the Facebook page, or whatever. This is good stuff. Thanks for listening. We appreciate your support. If you like the show, there are many ways to show your love. You can call the listener line at 206-222-CHAT. That's 206-222-2428. Or email us, technorama@chuckchat.com. Or follow us on Twitter, C. Tomasi, Step K, Technorama. You'll find all that and more on the website at chuckchat.com. Also want to give a special thanks to Mad Marv, who provides all our great blog content during the week. Everyone who sent us links during the week for the regular show, we really appreciate that. And thank you for downloading and listening. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with all the great podcasts over at farpointmedia.com. Go and check them out. We know you'll find something there you enjoy. You can get this show automatically delivered to you by finding the link on the website or go to iTunes and search for Technorama. Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, and here is a big binary high five. 101.